That's not a bad idea. There'll be a little bit of static here in audio land. All right. It'll work though. Okay. Okay, so this is what we're looking at today. We're on to John Locke's political philosophy. And let me draw a timeline up here, really just a basic one. We'll just take it from 1640-ish to, let's put 1700 over here. And just a couple events are relevant. Number one, the English Civil War, which ends in 1649 with the beheading of Charles I. Then the Puritans are in charge under Cromwell, and that's called the Interregnum, which is just Latin for between the kings or the reigns of Charles I and Charles II. Then you have, this is where John Locke shows up on the scene. He's just a student at Oxford over here. But then, as I said a couple weeks ago when we were introducing him, he became the personal physician of the Earl of Shaftesbury, who wanted to overthrow the government. And so when that plot got found out, Locke fled to Holland in the 1680s. And 1688 is the Glorious Revolution. James II is thrown out. So you had Charles II, James II. They're just taking it closer and closer and closer to full-out Romanist absolutism. And there was enough people who could at least agree with the Puritans on opposing that. Locke comes back, and you have William and Mary on the throne now, and now you have this era of toleration. And that's really the big idea, a lot of it, to John Locke's political philosophy. There's a lot of things in Locke that are good, that were informative to our founding fathers. I think people who, again, get their political philosophy from YouTube videos, or just most plural versities across our land, you might get the idea that John Locke created America. But the founding fathers were reading much more diversely than John Locke. But he does give us some good ideas and some things to think about. So, as a little bit of background, here's really two pieces of background that you need. One is the historical background, which I just gave you. The other are at least two books, and there are many others written. Two books written before this. One of them we've already covered. Let's put it right here, 1651. And that is Thomas Hobbes' book, The Leviathan. And then there's a book that was written in the 1630s, but for whatever reason it doesn't get published until 1682, and that was called The Patriarcha by a guy named Robert Filmer. Not as famous, but one that Locke directly seeks to contradict. His first treatise on government was an argument against Filmer. So I'm going to mention Filmer's argument just so you can get a context of it. And it's an argument that from our perspective, by our, I just mean Christians now, we might be somewhat ignorant of what the biblical view is, and we might have a hard time distinguishing between whether Filmer's argument or Locke's argument is the biblical view. There'll be no question that Thomas Hobbes' argument in The Leviathan is not the biblical view. That's going to be a view that really smacks of naturalistic evolution, and that's what we covered a couple weeks ago. But this one first. I have historical context here, but I think I pretty much covered that for the most part. I think the main idea, again, is that Locke had seen, or at least England had seen, two revolutions in his lifetime, one being a bloody revolution in the Civil War, when the Puritans came in, and then Cromwell died in 1658, so when you had the Restoration, you had another revolution. I saw a lot of persecution in there. Saw Catholics being, which a lot of these people, of course, didn't mind that, but Roman Catholics were given a certain degree of toleration under Elizabeth, maintained a certain degree of toleration, and then with Charles I and his Archbishop William Laud in 1630, you had basically an Arminian theology and a Roman Catholic public worship. That was Anglicanism. That was kind of the finished product. And that's why the Puritans so came to that cliff where they just couldn't take it anymore. In 1620, you had the Separatists come over, and those are the Puritans. And in 1630, you had Jonathan Winthrop and 30,000 other, I caught it in my notes last week to the kids, I put 30,000 people came over with Jonathan Winthrop, like 30,000 of them were on the boat. That's not what I meant. I just meant 30,000 in that wave of Puritans that came over. Well, most Puritans, of course, stayed in the church. They wanted to reform the church. And Charles II and his appointment of William Laud was just the last straw. There were all sorts of things that happened. There was just too much. This one guy, for example, William Pyre, I can't pronounce his name, but anyway, this is a guy that criticized the church in the late 1620s. He had his ear cut off, both ears, and as an act of mercy, they sewed him back on. Well, he was then caught making criticisms not only against the state, but against the church. So they cut his ears off again. You know, might as well. They're already, you know, it's a nice target. Anyway, so that was the charm of Charles I. And so I don't feel particularly bad that Charles was beheaded in 1649. Okay, so he was a plant of the Catholic royalist establishment of Europe. And England, English people, not just the Puritans, recognize that this is anti-England, okay? Anti-English citizens. But unfortunately, the young Locke really couldn't make all these connections. He came from a Puritan family himself. And you know what happens when you have the disadvantage of the advantage? Everything is mom and dad's fault, or at least people that look like them. Because I know them really well, and I'm pretty sure they don't know what they're talking about. So anytime I run into somebody that doesn't know what they're talking about, I associate that mentally with the easiest target. Well, that's what Locke does. It's perfect human nature. And by the time you get the Second Revolution, you have Charles II come in, and the Quakers, for example, who are already a little bit persecuted, now are becoming very persecuted. The Puritans were ejected from their pulpits in 1662. You had more and more and more of these laws that made it impossible for anybody but their guys, who were essentially Romanist in all their ways, to be heading the church. And so when Locke sees one of his friends being burned, another one being hanged for publishing views similar to his own. So when Locke sees all this, he sees the number one quality of the good society being toleration, free thought. And so that's going to inform him as to his understanding of liberty. Well, the second context to Locke is not the historical context, but in purple there, these two books. And we've already covered Hobbes, so let me just tell you a little something about this guy, Robert Filmer, in his book Patriarcha. And just hearing the word, you know that the English word patriarchy comes from the Greek patria and the Latin pater, and it just means father or fatherhood. And so Filmer's argument is going to borrow from biblical language, and he's going to borrow from things that have been long accepted throughout history. So he's going to make, so today, to most people, you know, when I first started studying political science in the mid-90s, I read the first treatise on government, except that I didn't get through it, because after two or three pages, I thought, what am I even reading this for? Nobody's going to take this seriously today. Who's he arguing against? This guy that nobody would ever pay attention to nowadays. And so I kind of just didn't pay attention to it. Well, of course, when I became a Christian, I started to say, okay, that's much more interesting now. Okay, because it sounds, at first glance, an awful lot like the biblical view. Well, Filmer's book was used by the champions of absolute monarchy in England and in France. Now, what's absolute monarchy? Just like the name would suggest, it's monarchy to the absolute, to the fullest. You don't have a constitutional monarchy. You don't have a monarchy that is, in any sense, subject to law. The king is law. Okay, so that's my basic definition of absolute monarchy. Now, the argument that Filmer makes is simple, but it's fallacious. Here's the argument. The first man, Adam, was given dominion by God. We agree with that. And that dominion encompassed the sphere of civil government. We agree with that too. Consequently, Adam was king over all of his posterity. And in like manner, the right of his royal line extended down from him to certain monarchs over all nations. And right there, there's a lot of practical and a lot of logical questions and textual questions that might come up. Because there's no doubt that the dominion of Adam does encompass the governmental sphere. But Filmer failed to recognize what would later be called sphere sovereignty, which describes the boundaries and the distinct prerogatives of the various spheres of the old and the new creation. So he saw unity with no diversity. He saw Adam's dominion, let's just put Adam in there, equals king. After all, Lord is just the English for that same word that we get dominion from. And within that, you could put any of the other institutions in the same circle. The family, the field of labor, and let's just put the state. So Adam is given dominion. Adam is given dominion over these. Dominion equals king. Therefore, Adam is the king over these. Okay, so that's what we would call an equivocation. Let's just put the equivocation at the word king. Okay? First of all, there's one, if you're a modern secular cynic, the most obvious argument against this is this argument. How on earth are you, let's put dot, 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 let's call it the dot, dot, dot problem. How on earth are you going to establish from all the different nations that lineage? Okay, so that would be it's one of the arguments against papal authority and apostolic succession. Show me the line. Show me the succession. Well, it's even tougher when you're going all the way back to the first man. Now, that's the easiest argument you can make against it. But there's better, more scriptural and logical arguments. But if anybody's surprised that such an argument could have any success, we should remember the turbulence under which the English people lived in the middle of the 17th century. And that's that historical backdrop. Okay, so it's as natural for us, I think, as it was for them to desire order. That was just the way they did order back then, and we're willing to give up our liberty and our rationality in order to have it. So that basic human problem psychologically hasn't really changed. So before we laugh at them and lapping up this argument, we should realize that we are susceptible to all sorts of arguments just like it. Other arguments besides Locke's were made against Filmer's book, and they'd already been written. One guy, James Tyrrell, who was a friend of Locke's, had written a book in 1681 called Patriarcha Non Monarcha. And you don't really have to know a whole lot of Latin to put that together. The patriarchy is not the monarchy. They're not the same. In other words, you've equivocated. There was another guy named Algernon Sidney who wrote some discourses at about the same time, and this was used as evidence against him in hanging him 2 years later. So Locke's seeing all this. He wants to make the same argument, but he doesn't want to get hung, and so he's writing this down in secret. One interesting thing also about Filmer is that how fairly he described the liberal position. And liberal, let me stop there. Let me define our terms. This is sometimes called classical liberalism, but I actually don't even want to do that here because that might be more clarifying, but oftentimes that is used by economists, so it's going to give us the most accurate description of what classical liberalism was. The problem with that is that when you're talking about political liberalism, I want to argue, as a lot of conservatives have, that political liberalism carries with it the seeds, the DNA, of radical liberalism. So I'm not really helped by calling it classical liberalism. So let me just stay even more generic at first and just call Locke's position in his civics political liberalism. Now that doesn't mean that later on people are not going to use the same phrase and espouse things that Locke would have disagreed with. Okay? But his final position, by the time you get to the 1689 and he comes back and he's free to publish all these writings now, is something that we would call political liberalism. Well, Filmer describes the liberal position in an interesting way, because it's going to be a fair description. He says, quote, mankind, is naturally endowed and born with freedom from all subjection, and at liberty to choose what form of government it please, and that the power which any one man hath over others was at first by human right bestowed according to the discretion of the multitude. Okay, so Filmer captures two things that really are central to Locke's view. Now, he's not writing against Locke because he doesn't know who Locke is yet. Okay, he's saying that mankind is born free and equal by law, such that the law stands over the king. Okay, now, right there, he could be saying something that is in agreement with another book that's written, which is much better than all of these, in 1644, which is Samuel Rutherford's book, Lex Rex, which says the law is king. And there you have the full biblical argument by Samuel Rutherford. That was the Puritan view. But let's ignore that because we're going to kick the Puritans out anyway. That's one thing everybody else could agree on. And so we're not going to pay any attention to that book, which would have actually been a good book for them to try to argue against, not these other straw men. But at any rate, Filmer does hit the nail right on the head. Political liberalism believes in liberty and equality. So let's put those up there. These are the twin pillars of political liberalism. Liberty and equality. That these two things, whatever they are, and we'll talk about them, are possessed by nature. Locke is a Christian. He will say they are endowed by God. That comes before the state. And Filmer adds, and therefore, the form of government is whatever the people want. Now, at the end there, it becomes very subjective. It's whatever the people want. Okay? So, well, I don't know how to just... These are the people, so I guess I'll put them over here. Let's just put a couple of them to represent that there's many of them. They use the word multitude. So let's put the word... let's put government by consent. Okay? Now, depending on what we're going to clarify all these terms as we go, but I think Filmer actually does a good job representing his opponent. Because this is how he defines political liberalism. He doesn't use the word liberalism, but he's saying some, these people, okay? So let's keep that on the board and let's keep that in mind. Filmer saw this one thing that Hobbes and Locke would have in common. Government is the creation of man's consent. Now, Locke's going to mean something different by liberty and equality as rights than Hobbes meant. But this flow chart, ending in government by consent, and then because they mean something different over here, what you can do with this government, Locke is eventually going to disagree with Hobbes about that too. But I think Filmer nails this. Government is the creation of man's consent. So it's not just government by consent. What that's going to come to mean is that government is the creation of man's consent. So that'll come in handy later. This is political liberalism, and this is what I would call an unchained political libertarianism. Okay, that's not informed by conservatism too. So we'll come back to that. But that flowchart is going to be absolutely important as we go on. Here's a difference between Locke and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes. Locke's liberalism retained the right of the people to abolish their own creation in favor of another. So at the end of that flowchart, for Locke, because all that was true, those people could abolish a form of government if it wasn't working out, if there was a decisive break in that covenant. Whereas with Hobbes, and I think it's safe to say Hobbes' statism, he renders that right null and void. Now, one political scientist says, Filmer knew that most people did not accept that these conclusions followed from the premise of original liberty. So in other words, Filmer was not worried that he was going to paint liberalism in an attractive light, because in Filmer's mind, most people won't buy this. Most people are biblical Christians like me, Filmer's thinking, And in the biblical view, God creates government and delegates authority, not man. And that was his single-minded focus. And on that particular point, Filmer would be right. Okay? So this scientist says, Filmer knew that most people did not accept that these conclusions followed from the premise of original liberty. They thought that liberty once given up could never be reclaimed. That rebellion could only be justified to restore, but never to transform the Constitution. And that freedom of speech must be curtailed in order to protect religion and the law. I don't know if it's just because I haven't had my coffee this morning or something, but my lips are like, you know, I don't know what's going on here. But right is light and all that good stuff. All right. So, we talked about Hobbes already. We saw that his Leviathan was written in 1651 when he was in exile, but that Hobbes eventually became free to put out his view there, especially in the 1660s. In about 1663, Locke published the lesser-known Essays on the Law of Nature, in which he gave an early assault on innate ideas. So if you're following his epistemology, innate ideas are going to actually, and his whole epistemology are going to have a lot to do with his political science. We saw how that works in Hobbes. Hobbes looked at everything in terms of the simple becoming the more complex. Simple ideas, complex ideas. Simple signals and symbols, then you get words and sentences. Simple desires to eat, whatever, kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it gets more and more complex. And as it does, those desires start coming into conflict with other people. You start sensing your own liberty, defending your stuff against other people, and that's how government evolves. And what does that make you think of? It makes you think of evolution, everything getting from the most simple to the most complex. So it shouldn't be hard to see how epistemology starts to determine politics. In this book, he does defend something like a law of nature. With Hobbes, in agreement with Hobbes, Locke needed to annihilate any essence of the civil law that rose above consent. And so liberty is going to be huge for Locke, as liberty should be. But there's no law that rises above consent, at first, in Locke's thinking. But against Hobbes, he needed to root justice in something prior to the civil law. So Locke has a dilemma. He's going to be more sophisticated than Hobbes. He had a better sense than Hobbes did that civil rightness had to be objectively right in some way. In other words, if this was going to be a right, then I'd better do a better job than Hobbes, who just winds up meaning by right he means liberty, and by liberty he means your ability and your interest in defending yourself. He doesn't actually mean that it's a right thing to do and its opposite would be objectively wrong. That you're actually the property of another, namely God, and that you actually have a duty. So when I say right, I actually also mean duty. Okay, Locke is thinking of this. He doesn't want this liberty to rise above the idea of consent, but he has a dilemma because he wants to do better than Hobbes at making this an objective duty that we actually owe to God. So, I see why I did that. I already defined political liberalism here. Let me add one more thing to this definition of political liberalism, because it's on there. My original order of my notes, I define political liberalism as the belief that all individuals are free and equal in relation to civil government. So that's just another definition of it. The belief that all individuals are free, that's liberty, and equal in relation to civil government. Now, by the way, if that definition seems too simple, it should. It's going to beg a lot of questions, and that becomes the problem with political liberalism. It's defined by what it's not rather than what it is. So the fact that it can undergo change and that these things can be nebulous shouldn't surprise us. Okay? When people use the term classical liberalism, we ought to always check whether it's an economist speaking or a political science or a scientist. That term can be applied to Adam Smith's economic theory. So Adam Smith, who's writing The Wealth of Nations century after this, 1776, classical liberalism can be defined as that kind of laissez-faire economics. The government hands off, where the economy is a separate thing from the government. It runs by laws that are hindered by government intervention and so on. That's classical liberalism, and it's obvious why that's called liberalism, because this is just from the word will in Latin. Okay, so we are free to choose as an economic actor. It's not a comprehensive view of ethics, it's just a view of economics. Okay, so that's why I have to distinguish between, okay, is it an economist speaking or is it a political scientist speaking when I hear the word classical liberalism? In our own generation, actually it's the generation before us now, a political scientist at Harvard named John Rawls in 1971 wrote a book called Political Liberalism and another called Theory of Justice, and he became kind of the standard bearer for modern political liberalism. In his view, the role of government was to stand above the fray of any moral philosophy. Okay, so law and even the government's relationship to economic activity has to stand above the fray of objective moral pronouncements. Except for that claim. Any claim to a transcendent good is precisely what has suppressed individual liberty and group liberty in the past. So, if I'm a political liberal and my fundamental principle is liberty, then objective moral pronouncements will war against my political liberalism, because it'll erode or suppress liberty. These two things are an irreconcilable tension. Now, as I said, classical liberalism in politics rested upon these twin pillars, liberty and equality. So this is the last thing from my original civics notes that I did for the older kids a couple weeks ago. This quote comes from Robert Bork's book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah. It was written in 1996, and if you want the best, or one of the best, political books written in the last 20 years still, Slouching Towards Gomorrah is a pretty good place to start. This is what he says at the very beginning. He's dissecting what he means by modern liberalism as opposed to classical liberalism. And he's saying, in a sense, what happened? It's a loaded question, he's going to tell you. What happened is that liberalism in itself carries the seeds of its own destruction. Not simply of society's destruction, but of its own destruction. And he quotes T.S. Eliot and others toward this end that and Edmund Burke and others that talk about this idea of liberty unconstrained becomes something else. And he shows the same thing with equality. Well, here's his formula. Listen to this statement by Bork and you'll get an idea of why this is. He says, quote, "The defining characteristics of modern liberalism are radical egalitarianism, the equality of outcomes rather than of opportunities, and radical individualism, the drastic reduction of limits to personal gratification." Now stop right there before I read the rest of the statement. What did he just say? He pretty much just said that the defining characteristics of modern liberalism are these two things in the original on steroids. Okay? Liberty on steroids, which he defines as radical individualism. Notice the ism. And radical egalitarianism, which is equality on steroids. You see that? So it's a radical, and the word radical comes from the Latin radix, which means to the root. Okay, so you have these two things chopping at the roots of something. Okay? They're no longer branches of reality. They're chopping at their own roots. Okay? So let me read the whole statement in context now so you can get the idea. "The defining characteristics of modern liberalism are radical egalitarianism, which is the equality of outcomes rather than of opportunities, and radical individualism, which is the drastic reduction of limits to personal gratification. These may seem an odd pair. For individualism means liberty. And liberty produces inequality, while equality of outcomes means coercion, and coercion destroys liberty." Here's what he just said. If you put these two on steroids, they have to, at some point, destroy each other. So let me read that last part again. Individualism means liberty, but liberty produces inequality. Why? Because if I'm free to choose, and one of us is taller, and one's shorter, one's faster, one's stronger, one's better with money, one's not, and so on and so forth, to let that happen will produce unequal results. As surely as you're already unequal in your DNA and all that stuff, and who your parents are and so forth. Okay, so that produces inequality. While equality of outcomes, if I force that, I have to coerce your liberty. Okay, so these two things, tore from their eternal moorings, become something radically different than the word would suggest. And so what Bork was recognizing at the beginning of his book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah, was that liberalism as a worldview in isolation does exactly what all truncated worldviews do. In pressing the finite as if it were infinite, the virtue becomes a vice. And in fact, it reveals that the virtue was not itself to begin with. So that is a background to Locke's liberalism. I'm going to get into his conservatism a little bit here, and then I'll go to break. And what I mean by his conservatism is that if I rewind from 1689, which is the finished product, I really don't want to erase that, but I'll get it back. I really don't want to erase it. If I rewind the clock to 1660, the restoration of the Catholic king, Charles II comes back in, John Locke wants to keep his position at Oxford. He's just got there. And in order to do that, I believe he's going to have views, which some of which he'll take back later in life. And it does raise the question of whether or not he was being a chameleon to save his own skin. But at any rate, you can see an evolution in his thought. At least two interesting questions from the early Locke show up in his second tract on government, which is not the same thing as his second treatise on government, which is published in 1689. These are in the 1660s. And he wrote another book called Essays on the Law of Nature. And he raises two interesting questions that will show him to not be a liberal at this point. Number one, can the civil magistrate specify indifferent things to be included within the order of divine worship and impose them upon the people? So what do you mean by indifferent things? Romans 14 things. Matters indifferent, which is a horrible name for it. But at any rate, that's what they've traditionally been called in many circles. So can the king impose elements of worship? Let's just call them that. Because it really doesn't matter if they are matters indifferent or if they're essential things or anywhere in between. Can the king do that? And then the second question he asks is each man's private interest the foundation of the law of nature? Now, to the first question, he answers, yes, the king can do that. Interesting for a liberal. And then is private interest the foundation to natural law and therefore all law? And on that, he's going to say, no. Okay? So, this is not the same Locke as later history would know him. His first tract was written in 1660, just as the Romanist king was settling back into power. And there, he cites the Scottish church as having a form of the confession that asks for the backing of the monarch. 2 years later, as the Puritans were under threat of expulsion from the churches, he wrote the second tract, which is nothing but line after line in praise of peace at all costs. He charges any view which champions liberty of conscience, any view that places the king under law, as ill-motivated and nothing but rabble-rousing. So at this point, Locke is so dead set on calling the whole Puritan experiment an exercise in hypocrisy and grandstanding that he's willing to take this very illiberal position. Without the magistrate's undivided authority, there can be no law. There can be no order. He must decide what the common good is, quote, according to his understanding of it. This is not a liberal, for sure, in that sense. Essentially, Locke argues that, quote, God, the supreme legislator, has nowhere denied the magistrate authority to concern himself with such matters, namely matters of religious worship. So to the first question. He basically makes a pragmatic argument, going back to the Elizabethan settlement, that no one would contemplate converting to a religion whose ceremonies seemed to him to be ridiculous. And so we have to go to this middle way between Rome and the Reformation, because that's what the English people are accustomed to. For the Puritans to fight against it is to fight against the course of nature. So Locke is, in a sense, including in natural law what the English are used to. And he's arguing that the king, in order to uphold order, has to uphold that. Well, Locke ignored what happens with the middle way in anything in life. The early Locke did not grasp how the middle always favors the downside against the upside. It's a kind of law of spiritual gravity. But at any rate, his idea is that the king comes into the sphere of public worship in order to keep the peace of this middle where the extremes would shred the country into civil unrest. So it's a civil matter, because if you allow the extremes to have their way, you would tear apart the fabric of society. With all this comes a repudiation of Rutherford and the Puritan political philosophy and a tacit agreement with the Hobbesian view. He says, quote, that the subject is bound passively to obey any decree of the magistrate whatsoever, whether it is just or unjust. There can be no possible justification for a private citizen's resisting the decrees of the magistrate by force of arms. Although, if the subject matter of the decree is unlawful, so he allows that the king can make a mistake, then the magistrate commits sin in commanding it. So what is Locke saying? Locke is saying, yes, the king can pass an unlawful law, but that will be punished in the future by God. For us, we are given to obey it. Does this sound familiar? Sounds like the two-kingdom pietistic view. Okay? So the profound Locke, what he would become by 1689, at this point, has a view that would not impress anybody that is so impressed by him today. You have a much more mature view, that's an understatement, from the Puritan political philosophy that he's criticizing. So, Locke does retain a category for divine law standing over civil law. But what does he do with it? I have on the right here a comparison between Aquinas' view of law and Locke's view of law. And what it comes to is this. On the left, you see this chart in Aquinas, where eternal law is the way things are in God. So it's not even in a circle. It's the way everything is in God's own righteousness. In the circle, you have the biggest category being natural law. Biggest, not in the sense necessarily just of source, but in a metaphysical sense. Because by nature, we mean the way anything is. In a sense, by natural law, we mean the law of identity. A equals A. Everything has a nature, and that nature is exactly what it is, and you can't cheat that. Okay? So that's what we mean by natural law. So everything is an element of natural law, and in the nature of the thing, to the degree that it's knowable. Inside that circle, we have this book that's opened. That, of course, is the Scriptures, and we put divine law in that. Divine law is not under natural law. That circle just represents everything versus these things, the way Calvin put it. I could have put Calvin up here with Aquinas, because Calvin would have totally agreed with this picture, but for the divine law, he might have put a bunch of spectacles. Glasses, because that's exactly the metaphor used in the Institutes, that special revelation is like a pair of spectacles to an old man whose sight is he can't see what's really there. Okay, but it's really there, but the Bible clarifies it and shows us things we couldn't see. Not that they weren't true, but that we couldn't see it apart from special revelation. All of that filters downward into the justness of particular human legislation, and that's civil law. So that's Aquinas' view. And Calvin and the original reformers. Locke will pay lip service to divine law being above these, but notice the defining characteristic of Locke's view. All of these are utterly separate, in separate spheres of life. So Locke has a category for divine law standing over civil law. So long as that divine law is inaccessible to the people, or at least inapplicable to the king by the people. So Locke, it's okay for Locke and his smart friends to quote Scripture against forms of government or forms of rebellion and so forth. But you people can't do that, holding the divine law over all of civil law. That's what the Puritans did, and that was just a bunch of grandstanding. Okay, so Locke does what so many young men do. He sees his parents in everything, or he sees his own reflection in everything. He tries to reform the world according to his own image. And he hears that, even in the best view. He didn't realize how much infinitely more sophisticated Rutherford's view was than his own. But to say that this principle is arbitrary and unproven would be an understatement. Locke divides law not by circles within circles, as Aquinas did, but as circles next to each other. He says, there is divine or moral, this is his breakdown, so divine or moral, he puts together on top, political or human, fraternal or concerned with charity, and individual or private. So you see those three circles on the bottom. He doesn't bother to root such a division in either any authority or any argument. He simply says that it will be, quote, more useful for our present purposes. Just trust my chart against the past 1700 years, because it'll be more useful for my argument. So when he continues, quote, thus divine law has God as its author. Human law is derived from some man in a position of authority, end quote. What did he just say? Divine law has God as its author. Sounds good. Sound like it's reverence is being paid to it. Human law is derived from some man in a position of authority. What do you mean derived? Do you mean that's its ultimate starting point? Do you mean that it's outside of divine law, unaccountable to divine law? Because he's already divided these into two different ultimate circles of source. And should anyone doubt that this divide is exactly what he means, he concludes that, quote, where the authority of divine law ends, there the authority of the magistrate begins. Stop right there. That is exactly what most people of the Gospel Coalition believe about pretty much everything, not just politics. Where the authority of divine law ends, where's that? Is there a part of life where God doesn't say, that's mine? I thought you guys liked Kuiper. That's not what Jesus means by the coin. Where the authority of divine law ends, there the authority of the magistrate begins. And everything which is undetermined and indifferent as far as the divine law is concerned, in other words, God, you missed a spot, and another, where everything which is undetermined and indifferent as far as the divine law is concerned is subject to the civil law, end quote. This is what happens when you think that everybody was an idiot before you and your smart friends came around. Is that you have to wind up lumping God in that former circle too. All right, I got a bunch of other things to say about natural law in Locke, but let me just end there for the first session, and then we'll pick up the final picture of his political liberalism when we come back.